claws, a slant-eyed snake being chopped to bits by a buzzsaw made of stars and stripes, and one of the vehicles had what looked like a machine gun mount on the passenger side. They were having a bang-up time just crashing around the desert at top speed and hassling anybody they met. "What outfit you fellas with?" one of them shouted. The engines were all roaring. We could barely hear each other. "The Sporting Press," I yelled. "We're friendlies. Hired geeks." Dim smiles. "If you want a good chase," I shouted, "you should get after that skunk from CBS News up ahead in the big black Jeep. He's the man responsible for the selling of the Pentagon." "Hot damn," two of them screamed at once. "A black Jeep, you say?" They roared off, and so did we, bouncing across the rocks and scrub oak cactus like iron tumbleweeds. The beer in my hand flew up and hit the top, then fell in my lap and soaked my crotch with warm foam. "You're fired," I said to the driver. "Take me back to the pits." It was time, I felt, to get grounded, to ponder this rotten assignment and figure out how to cope with it. Lacerda insisted on total coverage. He wanted to go back out in the dust storm and keep trying for some rare combination of film and lens that might penetrate the awful stuff. Joe, our driver, was willing. His name was not really Joe, but that's what we'd been instructed to call him. I had talked to the FOMOCO boss the night before, and when he mentioned the driver he was assigning to us, he said, "His real name is Steve, but you should call him Joe." "Why not?" I said. "We'll call him anything he wants. How about Zoom?" "No dice," said the Ford man. "It has to be Joe." Lacerda agreed, and sometime around noon, he went out on the desert again in the company of our driver, Joe. I went back to the blockhouse bar casino that was actually the Mint Gun Club, where I began to drink heavily, think heavily, and make many heavy notes. Six. A night on the town. Confrontation at the Desert Inn. Drug frenzy at the Circus Circus. Saturday, midnight. Memories of this night are extremely hazy. All I have for guide pegs is a pocket full of Keno cards and cocktail napkins, all covered with scribbled notes. Here is one. "Get the Ford man. Demand a Bronco for race observation purposes. Photos? Lacerda. Call. Why not a helicopter? Get on the phone. Lean on the fuckers. Heavy yelling." Another says, "Sign on Paradise Boulevard. Stopless and topless. Bush League sex compared to L.A. Pasties here. Total naked public humping in L.A. Las Vegas is a society of armed masturbators. Gambling is the kicker here. Sex is extra. Weird trip for high rollers. House whores for winners, hand jobs for the bad luck crowd." A long time ago, when I lived in Big Sur, down the road from Lionel Olay, I had a friend who liked to go to Reno for the crap shooting. He owned a sporting goods store in Carmel. And one month he drove his Mercedes highway cruiser to Reno on three consecutive weekends, winning heavily each time. After three trips, he was something like $15,000 ahead, so he decided to skip the fourth weekend and take some friends to dinner at Nepenthe. "Always quit winners," he explained, "and besides, it's a long drive." On Monday morning, he got a phone call from Reno, from the general manager of the casino he'd been working out on. "We missed you this weekend," said the GM. "The pit men were bored." "Shucks," said my friend. So the next weekend, he flew up to Reno in a private plane with a friend and two girls, all special guests of the GM. Nothing too good for high rollers. And on Monday morning, the same plane, the casino's plane, flew him back to the Monterey airport. The pilot lent him a dime to call a friend for a ride to Carmel. He was $30,000 in debt, and 2 months later he was looking down the barrel of one of the world's heaviest collection agencies. So he sold his store, but that didn't make the nut. They could wait for the rest, he said, but then he got stomped, which convinced him that maybe he'd be better off borrowing enough money to pay the whole wad. Mainline gambling is a very heavy business, and Las Vegas makes Reno seem like your friendly neighborhood grocery store. For a loser, Vegas is the meanest town on earth. Until about a year ago, there was a giant billboard on the outskirts of Las Vegas saying, "Don't gamble with marijuana. In Nevada, possession, 20 years. Sale, life." So I was not entirely at ease drifting around the casinos on this Saturday night with a car full of marijuana and head full of acid. We had several narrow escapes. At one point, I tried to drive the Great Red Shark into the laundry room of the Landmark Hotel, but the door was too narrow, and the people inside seemed dangerously excited. We drove over to the Desert Inn to catch the Debbie Reynolds Harry James show. "I don't know about you," I told my attorney, "but in my line of business, it's important to be hep." "Mine too," he said. "But as your attorney, I advise you to drive over to the Tropicana and pick up on Guy Lombardo. He's in the Blue Room with his Royal Canadians." "Why?" I asked. "Why what? Why should I pay out my hard-earned dollars to watch a fucking corpse?" "Look," he said, "why are we out here? To entertain ourselves or to do the job?" "The job, of course," I replied. We were driving around in circles, weaving through the parking lot of a place I thought was the dunes, but it turned out to be the Thunderbird, or maybe it was the Hacienda. My attorney was scanning the Vegas Visitor, looking for hints of action. "How about Nickel Nick's Slot Arcade?" he said. "Hot slots. That sounds heavy. 29-cent hot dogs." Suddenly, people were screaming at us. We were in trouble. Two thugs wearing red gold military overcoats were looming over the hood. "What the hell are you doing?" one screamed. "You can't park here." "Why not?" I said. It seemed like a reasonable place to park, plenty of space. I'd been looking for a parking space for what seemed like a very long time. Too long. I was about ready to abandon the car and call a taxi, but then, yes, we found this space, which turned out to be the sidewalk in front of the main entrance to the Desert Inn. I had run over so many curbs by this time that I hadn't even noticed this last one. But now we found ourselves in a position that was hard to explain, blocking the entrance, thugs yelling at us, bad confusion. My attorney was out of the car in a flash, waving a $5 bill. "We want this car parked. I'm an old friend of Debbie's. I used to romp with her." For a moment, I thought he had blown it. Then one of the doormen reached out for the bill, saying, "Okay, okay, I'll take care of it, sir." And he tore off a parking stub. "Holy shit," I said, as we hurried through the lobby. "They almost had us there. That was quick thinking." "What do you expect?" he said. "I'm your attorney, and you owe me $5. I want it. Now." I shrugged and gave him a bill. This garish, deep, Orlon-carpeted lobby of the Desert Inn seemed an inappropriate place to be haggling about nickel-dime bribes for the parking lot attendant. This was Bob Hope's turf, Frank Sinatra's, Spiro Agnew's. The lobby fairly reeked of high-grade formica and plastic palm trees. It was clearly a high-class refuge for big spenders. We approached the grand ballroom full of confidence, but they refused to let us in. "We were too late," said a man in a wine-colored tuxedo. "The house was already full, no seats left at any price." "Fuck seats," said my attorney. "We're old friends of Debbie's. We drove all the way from L.A. for this show, and we're goddamn well going in." The tux man began jabbering about fire regulations, but my attorney refused to listen. Finally, after a lot of bad noise, he let us in for nothing, provided we would stand quietly in back and not smoke. We promised, but the moment we got inside, we lost control. The tension had been too great. Debbie Reynolds was yucking across the stage in a silver afro wig to the tune of Sergeant Pepper from The Golden Trumpet of Harry James. "Jesus, creepin' shit," said my attorney. "We've wandered into a time capsule." Heavy hands grabbed our shoulders. I jammed the hash pipe back into my pocket just in time. We were dragged across the lobby and held against the front door by goons until our car was fetched up. "Okay, get lost," said the wine tux man. "We're giving you a break. If Debbie has friends like you guys, she's in worse trouble than I thought." "We'll see about this," my attorney shouted as we drove away. "You paranoid scum!" I drove around to the Circus Casino and parked near the back door. "This is the place," I said. "They'll never fuck with us here." "Where's the ether?" said my attorney. "This mescaline isn't working." I gave him the key to the trunk while I lit up the hash pipe. He came back with the ether bottle, uncapped it, then poured some into a Kleenex and mashed it under his nose, breathing heavily. I soaked another Kleenex and fouled my own nose. The smell was overwhelming, even with the top down. Soon we were staggering up the stairs toward the entrance, laughing stupidly and dragging each other along like drunks. This is the main advantage of ether. It makes you behave like the village drunkard in some early Irish novel. Total loss of all basic motor skills. Blurred vision, no balance, numb tongue. Severance of all connection between the body and the brain. Which is interesting because the brain continues to function more or less normally. You can actually watch yourself behaving in this terrible way. But you can't control it. You approach the turnstiles leading into the circus, and you know that when you get there, you have to give the man $2 or he won't let you inside. But when you get there, everything goes wrong. You misjudge the distance to the turnstile and slam against it, bounce off and grab hold of an old woman to keep from falling down. Some angry Rotarian shoves you and you think, "What's happening here? What's going on?" Then you hear yourself mumbling, "Dogs fuck the Pope, no fault of mine. Watch out. Why money? My name is Brinks. I was born. Get sheep overside. Women and children to armored car. Orders from Captain Zeep." Ah, devil ether. A total body drug. The mind recoils in horror, unable to communicate with the spinal column. The hands flap crazily, unable to get money out of the pocket. Garbled laughter and hissing from the mouth, always smiling. Ether is the perfect drug for Las Vegas. In this town, they love a drunk, fresh meat. So they put us through the turnstiles and turned us loose inside.
This ends Disc 1, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Disc 2.
The circus is what the whole hep world would be doing on Saturday night if the Nazis had won the war. This is the Sixth Reich. The ground floor is full of gambling tables, like all the other casinos. But the place is about four stories high, in the style of a circus tent, and all manner of strange county fair, Polish carnival madness is going on up in this space. Right above the gambling tables, the 40 Flying Carrizito brothers are doing a high-wire trapeze act, along with four muzzled wolverines and the six nymphet sisters from San Diego. So you're down on the main floor playing blackjack, and the stakes are getting high, when suddenly you chance to look up. And there, right smack above your head, is a half-naked 14-year-old girl being chased through the air by a snarling wolverine, which is suddenly locked in a death battle with two silver-painted Polacks who come swinging down from opposite balconies and meet in midair on the wolverine's neck. Both Polacks seize the animal as they fall straight down towards the crap tables, but they bounce off the net. They separate and spring back up towards the roof in three different directions. And just as they're about to fall again, They are grabbed out of the air by three Korean kittens and trapezed off to one of the balconies. This madness goes on, but nobody seems to notice. The gambling action runs 24 hours a day on the main floor, and the circus never ends. Meanwhile, on all the upstairs balconies, the customers are being hustled by every conceivable kind of bizarre shuck. All kinds of funhouse-type booths. Shoot the pasties off the nipples of a 10-foot bull dyke and win a cotton candy goat. Stand in front of this fantastic machine, my friend, and for just 99 cents, your likeness will appear 200 feet tall on a screen above downtown Las Vegas. 99 cents more for a voice message. Say whatever you want, fella. They'll hear you. Don't worry about that. Remember, you'll be 200 feet tall. Jesus Christ. I could see myself lying in bed in the Mint Hotel, half asleep, and staring idly out the window when suddenly a vicious Nazi drunkard appears 200 feet tall in the midnight sky, screaming gibberish at the world. Woodstock, Uber alles! We will close the drapes tonight. A thing like that could send a drug person careening around the room like a ping-pong ball. Hallucinations are bad enough, but after a while you learn to cope with things like seeing your dead grandmother crawling up your leg with a knife in her teeth. Most acid fanciers can handle this sort of thing. But nobody can handle that other trip. The possibility that any freak with $1.98 can walk into the circus and suddenly appear in the sky over downtown Las Vegas 12 times the size of God, howling anything that comes into his head. No, this is not a good town for psychedelic drugs. Reality itself is too twisted. Good mescaline comes on slow. The first hour is all waiting, then about halfway through the second hour you start cursing the creep who burned you, because nothing is happening. And then, zang! Fiendish intensity, strange glow and vibrations. A very heavy gig in a place like the circus. I hate to say this, said my attorney as we sat down at the merry-go-round bar on the second balcony, but this place is getting to me. I think I'm getting the fear. Nonsense, I said. We came out here to find the American dream, and now that we're right in the vortex, you want to quit. I grabbed his bicep and squeezed. You must realize, I said, that we've found the main nerve. I know, he said. That's what gives me the fear. The ether was wearing off. The acid was long gone. But the mescaline was running strong. We were sitting at a small round gold formica table, moving in orbit around the bartender. Look over there, I said. Two women fucking a polar bear. Please, he said. Don't tell me those things. Not now. He signaled the waitress for two more wild turkeys. This is my last drink, he said. How much money can you lend me? Not much, I said. Why? I have to go, he said. Go? Yes, leave the country tonight. Calm down, I said. You'll be straight in a few hours. No, he said. This is serious. George Metesky was serious, I said, and you see what they did to him. Don't fuck around, he shouted. One more hour in this town and I'll kill somebody. I could see he was on the edge, that fearful intensity that comes at the peak of a mescaline seizure. Okay, I said, I'll lend you some money. Let's go outside and see how much we have left. Can we make it? He said. Well, it depends on how many people we fuck with between here and the door. You want to leave quietly? I want to leave fast, he said. Okay, let's pay this bill and get up very slowly. We're both out of our heads. This is going to be a long walk. I shouted at the waitress for a bill. She came over looking bored and my attorney stood up. Do they pay you to screw that bear? He asked. What? He's just kidding, I said, stepping between them. Come on, Doc, let's go downstairs and gamble. I got him as far as the edge of the bar, the rim of the merry-go-round, but he refused to get off until it stopped turning. It won't stop, I said. It's not ever gonna stop. I stepped off and turned around to wait for him, but he wouldn't move. And before I could reach out and pull him off, he was carried away. Don't move, I shouted. You'll come around. His eyes were staring blindly ahead, squinting with fear and confusion, but he didn't move a muscle until he'd made the whole circle. I waited until he was almost in front of me, then I reached out to grab him, but he jumped back and went around the circle again. This made me very nervous. I felt on the verge of a freakout. The bartender seemed to be watching us. Carson City, I thought. 20 years. I stepped on the merry-go-round and hurried around the bar, approaching my attorney on his blind side. And when we came to the right spot, I pushed him off. He staggered into the aisle and uttered a hellish scream as he lost his balance and went down, thrashing into the crowd, rolling like a log, then up again in a flash, fists clenched, looking for somebody to hit. I approached him with my hands in the air, trying to smile. You fell, I said. Let's go. By this time, people were watching us, but the fool wouldn't move, and I knew what would happen if I grabbed him. Okay, I said. You stay here and go to jail. I'm leaving. I started walking fast towards the stairs, ignoring him. This moved him. Did you see that? He said as he caught up with me. Some son of a bitch kicked me in the back. Probably the bartender, I said. He wanted to stomp you for what you said to the waitress. Good God! Let's get out of here. Where's the elevator? Don't go near that elevator, I said. That's just what they want us to do. Trap us in a steel box and take us down to the basement. I looked over my shoulder, but nobody was following. Don't run, I said. They'd like an excuse to shoot us. He nodded, seeming to understand. We walked fast along the big indoor midway, shooting galleries, tattoo parlors, money changers, and cotton candy booths, then out through a bank of glass doors and across the grass downhill to a parking lot where the Red Shark waited. You drive, he said. I think there's something wrong with me. Seven. Paranoid terror and the awful specter of sodomy. A flashing of knives and green water. When we got to the Mint, I parked on the street in front of the casino, around a corner from the parking lot. No point risking a scene in the lobby, I thought. Neither one of us could pass for drunk. We were both hyper-tense, extremely menacing vibrations all around us. We hurried through the casino and up the rear escalator. We made it to the room without meeting anybody, but the key wouldn't open the door. My attorney was struggling desperately with it. Those bastards have changed the lock on us, he groaned. They probably searched the room. Jesus, we're finished. Suddenly, the door swung open. We hesitated, then hurried inside. No sign of trouble. Bolt everything, said my attorney. Use all chains. He was staring at two Mint Hotel room keys in his hand. Where did this one come from? He said, holding up a key with number 1221 on it. That's Lacerda's room, I said. He smiled. Yeah, that's right. I thought we might need it. What for? Let's go up there and blast him out of bed with a fire hose, he said. No, I said. We should leave the poor bastard alone. I get the feeling he's avoiding us for some reason. Don't kid yourself, he said. That Portuguese son of a bitch is dangerous. He's watching us like a hawk. He squinted at me. Have you made a deal with him? I talked with him on the phone, I said, while you were out getting the car washed. He said he was turning in early so he can get out there to the starting line at dawn. My attorney was not listening. He uttered an anguished cry and smacked the wall with both hands. That dirty bastard, he shouted. I knew it. He got hold of my woman. I laughed. That little blonde groupie with the film crew? You think he sodomized her? That's right, laugh about it, he yelled. You goddamn honkies are all the same. By this time he'd opened a new bottle of tequila and was quaffing it down. Then he grabbed a grapefruit and sliced it in half with a Gerber Mini Magnum, a stainless steel hunting knife with a blade like a fresh-honed straight razor. Where'd you get that knife? I asked. Room service sent it up, he said. I wanted something to cut the limes. What limes? They didn't have any, he said. They don't grow out here in the desert. He sliced the grapefruit into quarters, then into eighths, then sixteenths. Then he began slashing aimlessly at the residue. That dirty toad bastard, he groaned. I knew I should have taken him out when I had the chance. Now he has her. I remembered the girl. We'd had a problem with her on the elevator a few hours earlier. My attorney had made a fool of himself. You must be a writer, she'd said. What class are you in? Class, he snapped. What the fuck do you mean? What do you ride? She asked with a quick smile. We're filming the race for a TV series. Maybe we can use you. Use me? Mother of God, I thought, here it comes. The elevator was crowded with race people. It was taking a long time to get from floor to floor. By the time we'd stopped at three, he was trembling badly. Five more to go. I ride the big ones, he shouted suddenly. The really big fuckers. I laughed, trying to defuse the scene. The Vincent Black Shadow, I said. We're with the factory team. This brought a murmur of rude dissent from the crowd. Bullshit, somebody behind me muttered. Wait a minute, my attorney shouted, and then to the girl, pardon me, lady, but I think there's some kind of ignorant chicken sucker in this car who needs his face cut open. He plunged his hand into the pocket of his black plastic jacket and turned to face the people crowded into the rear of the elevator. You cheap honky faggots, he snarled. Which one of you wants to get cut? I was watching the overhead floor indicator. The door opened at 7, but nobody moved. Dead silence. The door closed. Up to 8. Then open again. Still no sound or movement in the crowded car. Just as the door began to close, I stepped off and grabbed his arm, jerking him out just in time. The door slid shut, and the elevator light dinged 9. Quick, into the room, I said. Those bastards will have the pigs on us. We ran around the corner to the room. My attorney was laughing wildly. Spooked, he shouted. Did you see that? They were spooked like rats in a death cage. Then as we bolted the door behind us, he stopped laughing. God damn, he said. It's serious now. That girl understood. She fell in love with me. Now, many hours later, he was convinced that Lacerda, the so-called photographer, had somehow got his hands on the girl. Let's go up there and castrate that fucker, he said, waving his new knife around in quick circles in front of his teeth. Did you put him onto her? Look, I said, you'd better put that goddamn blade away and get your head straight. I have to put the car in the lot. I was backing slowly towards the door. One of the things you learn after years of dealing with drug people is that everything is serious. You can turn your back on a person, but never turn your back on a drug, especially when it's waving a razor-sharp hunting knife in your eyes. Take a shower, I said. I'll be back in 20 minutes. I left quickly, locking the door behind me and taking the key to Lacerda's room, the one my attorney had stolen earlier. That poor geek, I thought, as I hurried down the escalator. They sent him out here on this perfectly reasonable assignment. Just a few photos of motorcycles and dune buggies racing around the desert. And now he was plunged, without realizing it, into the maw of some world beyond his ken. There was no way he could possibly understand what was happening. What were we doing out here? What was the meaning of this trip? Did I actually have a big red convertible out there on the street? Was I just roaming around these mint hotel escalators in a drug frenzy of some kind, or had I really come out here to Las Vegas to work on a story? I reached in my pocket for the room key. 1850, it said. At least that much was real. So my immediate task was to deal with the car and get back to that room, and then hopefully get straight enough to cope with whatever might happen at dawn. Now off the escalator and into the casino, big crowd still tight around the crap tables. Who are these people? These faces? Where do they come from? They look like caricatures of used car dealers from Dallas. But they're real. And sweet Jesus, there are a hell of a lot of them still screaming around these desert city crap tables at 4:30 on a Sunday morning. Still humping the American dream. That vision of the big winner somehow emerging from the last-minute pre-dawn chaos of a stale Vegas casino. Big strike in Silver City. Beat the dealer and go home rich. Why not? I stopped at the money wheel and dropped a dollar on Thomas Jefferson. A $2 bill. The straight freak ticket. Thinking, as always, that some idle instinct bet might carry the whole thing off. But no. Just another $2 down the tube, you bastards. No, calm down. Learn to enjoy losing. The important thing is to cover this story on its own terms. Leave the other stuff to life and look, at least for now. On the way down the escalator, I saw the life man twisted feverishly into the telegraph booth, chanting his wisdom into the ear of some horny robot in a cubicle on that other coast. Indeed, Las Vegas at dawn. The racers are still asleep. The dust is still on the desert. $50,000 in prize money slumbers darkly in the office safe at Del Webb's fabulous Mint Hotel in the bright heart of Casino Center. Extreme tension, and our life team is here, as always, with a sturdy police escort. Pause. Yes, operator, that word was police. What else? This is, after all, a life special. The Red Shark was out on Fremont, where I'd left it. I drove around to the garage and checked it in. Dr. Gonzo's car, no problem. And if any of your men fall idle, we can use a total wax job before morning. Yes, of course. Just bill the room. My attorney was in the bathtub when I returned, submerged in green water, the oily product of some Japanese bath salts he'd picked up in the hotel gift shop, along with a new AM/FM radio plugged into the electric razor socket. Top volume. Some gibberish by a thing called Three Dog Night about a frog named Jeremiah who wanted joy to the world. First Lennon, now this, I thought. Next we'll have Glenn Campbell screaming, "Where have all the flowers gone?" Where indeed? No flowers in this town. Only carnivorous plants. I turned the volume down and noticed a hunk of chewed-up white paper beside the radio. My attorney seemed not to notice the sound change. He was lost in a fog of green steam. Only half his head was visible above the waterline. "You ate this?" I asked, holding up the white pad. He ignored me, but I knew. He would be very difficult to reach for the next 6 hours. The whole blotter was chewed up. "You evil son of a bitch," I said. "You better hope there's some Thorazine in that bag, because if there's not, you're in bad trouble tomorrow." "Music," he snarled. "Turn it up. Put that tape on." "What tape?" "The new one. It's right there." I picked up the radio and noticed that it was also a tape recorder, one of those things with a cassette unit built in. And the tape, surrealistic pillow, needed only to be flipped over. He had already gone through side one at a volume that must have been audible in every room within a radius of 100 yards, walls and all. "White Rabbit," he said, "I want a rising sound." "You're doomed," I said. "I'm leaving here in 2 hours, and then they're going to come up here and beat the mortal shit out of you with big saps right there in the tub." "I dig my own graves," he said. "Green water and the White Rabbit. Put it on. Don't make me use this." His arm lashed out of the water, the hunting knife gripped in his fist. "Jesus," I muttered. And at that point I figured he was beyond help, lying there in the tub with a head full of acid and the sharpest knife I've ever seen, totally incapable of reason, demanding the White Rabbit. "This is it," I thought. "I've gone as far as I can with this waterhead. This time it's a suicide trip. This time he wants it. He's ready." "Okay," I said, turning the tape over and pushing the play button. "But do me one last favor, will you? Can you give me 2 hours? That's all I ask, just 2 hours to sleep before tomorrow. I suspect it's going to be a very difficult day." "Of course," he said. "I'm your attorney. I'll give you all the time you need at my normal rates. $45 an hour. But you'll be wanting a cushion, so why don't you just lay one of those $100 bills down there beside the radio and fuck off?" "How about a check?" I said. "On the Sawtooth National Bank. You won't need any ID to cash it there. They know me." "Whatever's right," he said, beginning to jerk with the music. The bathroom was like the inside of a huge defective woofer. Heinous vibrations, overwhelming sound. The floor was full of water. I moved the radio as far from the tub as it would go. Then I left and closed the door behind me. Within seconds, he was shouting at me. "Help, you bastard! I need help!" I rushed back inside, thinking he'd sliced off an ear by accident. But no. He was reaching across the bathroom toward the white formica shelf where the radio sat. "I want that fucking radio," he snarled. I grabbed it away from his hand. "You fool," I said. "Get back in that tub. Get away from that goddamn radio." I shoved it back from his hand. The volume was so far up that it was hard to know what was playing unless you knew Surrealistic Pillow almost note for note, which I did at the time. So I knew that White Rabbit had finished. The peak had come and gone. But my attorney, it seemed, had not made it. He wanted more. "Back the tape up," he yelled. "I need it again." His eyes were full of craziness now, unable to focus. He seemed on the verge of some awful psychic orgasm. "Let it roll," he screamed. "Just as high as the fucker can go, and when it comes to that fantastic note where the rabbit bites its own head off, I want you to throw that fucking radio into the tub with me." I stared at him, keeping a firm grip on the radio. "Not me," I said finally. "I'd be happy to ram a goddamn 440-volt cattle prod into that tub with you right now, but not this radio. It would blast you right through the wall, stone dead in 10 seconds. I laughed. "Shit, they'd make me explain it. Drag me down to some rotten coroner's inquest and grill me about, yes, the exact details. I don't need that." "Bullshit," he screamed. "Just tell them I wanted to get higher." I thought for a moment. "Okay," I said finally. "You're right. This is probably the only solution." I picked up the tape radio, which was still plugged in, and held it over the tub. "Just let me make sure I have it all lined up," I said. "You want me to throw this thing into the tub when White Rabbit peaks, is that it?" He fell back in the water and smiled gratefully. "Fuck yes," he said. "I was beginning to think I was going to have to go out and get one of the goddamn maids to do it." "Don't worry," I said. "Are you ready?" I hit the play button, and White Rabbit started building again. Almost immediately, he began to howl and moan. Another fast run up that mountain, and thinking, this time, that he would finally get over the top. His eyes were gripped shut, and only his head and both kneecaps poked up through the oily green water. I let the song build while I sorted through the pile of fat, ripe grapefruit next to the basin. The biggest one of the lot weighed almost 2 pounds. I got a good Vita Blue fastball grip on the fucker, and just as White Rabbit peaked, I lashed it into the tub like a cannonball. My attorney screamed crazily, thrashing around in the tub like a shark after meat, churning water all over the floor as he struggled to get hold of something. I jerked the AC cord out of the tape radio and moved out of the bathroom very quickly. The machine kept on playing, but now it was back on its own harmless battery power. I could hear the beat cooling down as I moved across the room to my kit bag and fetched up the mace can, just as my attorney ripped the bathroom door open and started out. His eyes were still unfocused, but he was waving the blade out in front of him like a man who meant to cut something. "Mace!" I shouted. "You want this?" I waved the mace bomb in front of his watery eyes. He stopped. "You bastard," he hissed. "You'd do that, wouldn't you?" I laughed, still waving the bomb at him. "Why worry? You like it. Shit, there's nothing in the world like a mace high. 45 minutes on your knees with the dry heaves, gasping for breath. It'll calm you right down." He stared in my general direction, trying to focus. "You cheap, honky son of a bitch," he muttered. "You'd do it, wouldn't you?" "Why not?" I said. "Hell, just a minute ago you were asking me to kill you, and now you want to kill me. What I should do, goddammit, is call the police." He sagged. "The cops?" I nodded. "Yeah, there's no choice. I wouldn't dare go to sleep with you wandering around in this condition with a head full of acid and wanting to slice me up with that goddamn knife." He rolled his eyes for a moment, then tried to smile. "Who said anything about slicing you up?" he mumbled. "I just wanted to carve a little Z on your forehead, nothing serious." He shrugged and reached for a cigarette on top of the TV set. I menaced him again with the mace can. "Get back in that tub," I said. "Eat some reds and try to calm down. Smoke some grass, shoot some smack, shit, do whatever you have to do, but let me get some rest." He shrugged and smiled distractedly, as if everything I'd said made perfect sense. "Hell yes," he said very earnestly. "You really need some sleep. You have to work tomorrow." He shook his head sadly and turned back toward the bathroom. "God damn. What a bummer." He waved me off. "Try to rest," he said. "Don't let me keep you up." I nodded and watched him shuffle back into the bathroom, still holding the blade, but now he seemed unaware of it. The acid had shifted gears on him. The next phase would probably be one of those hellishly intense introspection nightmares. 4 hours or so of catatonic despair, but nothing physical, nothing dangerous. I watched the door close behind him, and I quietly slid a heavy, sharp-angled chair up in front of the bathroom knob and put the mace can beside the alarm clock. The room was very quiet. I walked over to the TV set and turned it on to a dead channel. White noise at maximum decibels. A fine sound for sleeping. A powerful, continuous hiss to drown out everything strange. Eight. I quote from Art Linkletter. "Genius round the world stands hand in hand, and one shock of recognition runs the whole circle round." I live in a quiet place where any sound at night means something is about to happen. You come awake fast, thinking, "What does that mean?" Usually nothing. But sometimes, It's hard to adjust to a city gig where the night is full of sounds, all of them comfortably routine. Cars, horns, footsteps. No way to relax. So drown it all out with the fine white drone of a cross-eyed TV set. Jam the bugger between channels and doze off nicely. Ignore that nightmare in the bathroom. Just another ugly refugee from the love generation. Some doom-struck gimp who couldn't handle the pressure. My attorney has never been able to accept the notion, often espoused by reformed drug abusers and especially popular among those on probation, that you can get a lot higher without drugs than with them. And neither have I, for that matter. But I once lived down the hill from Dr. Blank on Blank Road. The name's deleted at insistence of publisher's lawyer. A former acid guru who later claimed to have made that long jump from chemical frenzy to preternatural consciousness. One fine afternoon in the first rising curl of what would soon become the great San Francisco acid wave, I stopped by the good doctor's house with the idea of asking him, since he was even then a known drug authority, what sort of advice he might have for a neighbor with a healthy curiosity about LSD. I parked on the road and lumbered up his gravel driveway, pausing en route to wave pleasantly at his wife, who was working in the garden under the brim of a huge seeding hat. A good scene, I thought. The old man is inside brewing up one of his fantastic drug stews, and here we see his woman out in the garden pruning carrots or whatever, humming while she works some tune I fail to recognize. Humming, yes. But it would be nearly 10 years before I would recognize that sound for what it was, like Ginsberg far gone in the ohm. Dr. Blank was trying to hum me off. That was no old lady out there in that garden. It was the good doctor himself. And his humming was a frantic attempt to block me out of his higher consciousness. I made several attempts to make myself clear. Just a neighbor come to call and ask the doctor's advice about gobbling some LSD in my shack just down the hill from his house. I did, after all, have weapons. And I like to shoot them. Especially at night when the great blue flame would leap out, along with all that noise. And yes, the bullets too. We couldn't ignore that. Big balls of lead alloy flying around the valley at speeds up to 3,700 feet per second. But I always fired into the nearest hill, or failing that, into blackness. I meant no harm. I just liked the explosions. And I was careful never to kill more than I could eat. Kill? I realized I could never properly explain that word to this creature toiling here in its garden. Had it ever eaten meat? Could it conjugate the verb hunt? Did it understand hunger, or grasp the awful fact that my income averaged around $32 a week that year? No. No hope of communication in this place. I recognize that. But not soon enough to keep the drug doctor from humming me all the way down his driveway and into my car and down the mountain road. Forget LSD, I thought. Look what it's done to that poor bastard. So I stuck with hash and rum for another 6 months or so until I moved into San Francisco and found myself one night in a place called the Fillmore Auditorium. And that was that. One gray lump of sugar, and boom. In my mind, I was right back there in the doctor's garden. Not on the surface, but underneath, poking up through that finely cultivated earth like some kind of mutant mushroom. A victim of the drug explosion. A natural street freak, just eating whatever came by. I recall one night in the Matrix when a road person came in with a big pack on his back shouting, "Anybody want some LSD? I got all the makings right here. All I need is a place to cook." The manager was on him at once, mumbling, "Cool it, cool it. Come on back to the office." I never saw him after that night, but before he was taken away, the road person distributed his samples. Huge white spatules. I went into the men's room to eat mine, but only half at first, I thought. Good thinking, but a hard thing to accomplish under the circumstances. I ate the first half, but spilled the rest on the sleeve of my red Pendleton shirt, and then, wondering what to do with it, I saw one of the musicians come in. "What's the trouble?" he said. "Well," I said, "all this white stuff on my sleeve is LSD. He said nothing, merely grabbed my arm and began sucking on it. A very gross tableau. I wondered what would happen if some Kingston Trio young stockbroker type might wander in and catch us in the act. Fuck him, I thought. With a bit of luck, it'll ruin his life, forever thinking that just behind some narrow door in all his favorite bars, men in red Pendleton shirts are getting incredible kicks from things he'll never know. Would he dare to suck a sleeve? Probably not. Play it safe. Pretend you never saw it. Strange memories on this nervous night in Las Vegas. 5 years later? Six? It seems like a lifetime, or at least a main era. The kind of peak that never comes again. San Francisco in the middle 60s was a very special time and place to be a part of. Maybe it meant something. Maybe not in the long run. But no explanation, no mix of words or music or memories can touch that sense of knowing that you were there and alive in that corner of time and the world, whatever it meant. History is hard to know because of all the hired bullshit. But even without being sure of history, it seems entirely reasonable to think that every now and then the energy of a whole generation comes to a head in a long, fine flash, for reasons that nobody really understands at the time, and which never explain, in retrospect, what actually happened. My central memory of that time seems to hang on one or five or maybe 40 nights, or very early mornings, when I left the Fillmore half crazy, and instead of going home, aimed the big 650 Lightning across the Bay Bridge at 100 miles an hour wearing L.L. Bean shorts and a Butte sheep herder's jacket, booming through the Treasure Island Tunnel at the lights of Oakland and Berkeley and Richmond, not quite sure which turnoff to take when I got to the other end, always stalling at the toll gate, too twisted to find neutral while I fumble for change, but being absolutely certain that no matter which way I went, I would come to a place where people were just as high and wild as I was. No doubt at all about that. There was madness in any direction at any hour. If not across the bay, then up the Golden Gate, or down 101 to Los Altos or La Honda. You could strike sparks anywhere. There was a fantastic universal sense that whatever we were doing was right, that we were winning. And that, I think, was the handle. That sense of inevitable victory over the forces of old and evil. Not in any mean or military sense. We didn't need that. Our energy would simply prevail. There was no point in fighting, on our side or theirs. We had all the momentum. We were riding the crest of a high and beautiful wave. So now, less than 5 years later, you can go up on a steep hill in Las Vegas and look west, and with the right kind of eyes, you can almost see the high water mark. That place where the wave finally broke and rolled back. Nine. No sympathy for the devil. Newsmen tortured? Flight into madness. The decision to flee came suddenly, or maybe not. Maybe I'd planned it all along, subconsciously waiting for the right moment. The bill was a factor, I think, because I had no money to pay it, and no more of these devilish credit card reimbursement deals. Not after dealing with Sidney Zion. They seized my American Express card after that one, and now the bastards are suing me, along with the Diners Club and the IRS. And besides, the magazine is legally responsible. My attorney saw to that. We signed nothing, except those room service tabs. We never knew the total, but just before we left, my attorney figured we were running somewhere between $29 and $36 per hour for 48 consecutive hours. Incredible, I said. How could it happen? By the time I asked this question, there was nobody around to answer. My attorney was gone. He must have sensed trouble. On Monday evening, he ordered up a set of fine cowhide luggage from room service, then told me he had reservations on the next plane to L.A. We would have to hurry, he said. And on the way to the airport, he borrowed $25 for the plane ticket. I saw him off. Then I went back to the airport souvenir counter and spent all the rest of my cash on garbage. Complete shit. Souvenirs of Las Vegas. Plastic fake Zippo lighters with a built-in roulette wheel for $6.95. JFK half-dollar money clips for $5 each. Tin apes that shook dice for $7.50. I loaded up on this crap, then carried it out to the Great Red Shark and dumped it all in the back seat. And then I stepped into the driver's seat in a very dignified way. The white top was rolled back, as always, and I sat there and turned the radio on and began thinking. How would Horatio Alger handle this situation? One toke over the line, sweet Jesus, one toke over the line. Panic! It crept up my spine like the first rising vibes of an acid frenzy. All these horrible realities began to dawn on me. Here I was, all alone in Las Vegas with this goddamn incredibly expensive car, completely twisted on drugs, no attorney, no cash, no story for the magazine, and on top of everything else, I had a gigantic goddamn hotel bill to deal with. We had ordered everything into that room that human hands could carry, including 600 bars of translucent Neutrogena soap. The whole car was full of it. All over the floors, the seats, the glove compartment. My attorney had worked out some kind of arrangement with the mestizo maids on our floor to have this soap delivered to us. 600 bars of this weird transparent shit, and now it was all mine. Along with this plastic briefcase that I suddenly noticed right beside me on the front seat, I lifted the fucker and knew immediately what was inside. No Samoan attorney in his right mind is going to stomp through the metal detector gates of a commercial airline with a fat black 357 Magnum on his person. So he had left it with me for delivery, if I made it back to L.A. Otherwise, well, I could almost hear myself talking to the California Highway Patrol. What? This weapon? This loaded, unregistered, concealed, and maybe hot 357 Magnum? What am I doing with it? Well, you see, officer, I pulled off the road near Mescal Springs on the advice of my attorney, who subsequently disappeared, and all of a sudden, while I was just sort of walking around that deserted waterhole by myself for no reason at all, when this little fella with a beard came up to me out of nowhere, and he had this horrible linoleum knife in one hand and this huge black pistol in the other hand. And he offered to carve a big X on my forehead in memory of Lieutenant Callie. But when I told him I was a doctor of journalism, his whole attitude changed. Yes, you probably won't believe this, officer, but he suddenly hurled that knife into the brackish mescal waters near our feet. And then he gave me this revolver. Right, he just shoved it into my hand, butt first. And then he ran off into the darkness. So, that's why I have this weapon, officer. Can you believe that? No. But I wasn't about to throw the bastard away, either. A good 357 is a hard thing to get these days. So I figured, well, just get this bugger back to Malibu and it's mine. My risk, my gun. It made perfect sense. And if that Samoan pig wanted to argue, if he wanted to come yelling around the house, give him a taste of the bugger about midway up the femur. Indeed, 158 grains of half-jacketed lead alloy traveling 1,500 feet per second equals about 40 pounds of Samoan hamburger mixed up with bone splinters. Why not? Madness. Madness. And meanwhile, all alone with the great red shark in the parking lot of the Las Vegas airport. To hell with this panic. Get a grip. Maintain. For the next 24 hours, this matter of personal control will be critical. Here I am, sitting out here alone, on this fucking desert, in this nest of armed loonies, with a very dangerous carload of hazards, horrors, and liabilities, that I must get back to L.A. Because if they nail me out here, I'm doomed. Completely fucked. No question about that. No future for a doctor of journalism.